As heated discussions about sexual harassment and assault continue across the nation, state laws in California will be changing to address the Me Too movement. Today on Insight, Cal Matters reporter Laurel Rosenhall talks about the more than 24 bills introduced to fight workplace misconduct and hold offenders accountable, and which ones were signed by Governor Jerry Brown. Mental illness is more common than you might think, and it's not always what you think. We'll hear how Sacramento County plans to use a collaborative art exhibit to share stories and stop stigma. And what's in a name? Northern California has its fair share of cities and towns with unusual names, from Bootjack to Rough and Ready. Cap Radio's Emily Zentner explains the often fun history behind them. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. Tensions are high in Washington and across the nation today on the eve of the U.S. Senate vote on whether to confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States. He is accused of sexual assault and misconduct during his time in high school and college. Those allegations have led to a bitter partisan battle. Here in California, our state laws are changing following the Me Too movement. Lawmakers introduced more than 24 bills to fight workplace misconduct and hold offenders accountable. As he is known to do, Governor Jerry Brown was a little unpredictable. He sided with victims' advocates in some cases and sided with employers in some others. CalMatters reporter Laurel Rosenhall joins us for a Capital Chat with a rundown of how Governor Brown approached the Me Too-inspired bills that sought his signature. Laurel, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So lawmakers introduced more than 24 bills this year that were inspired by the Me Too movement. What was the political dynamic on this issue? Who was for the bills and who was lobbying against them?
Well, in general, this wasn't true on every single bill, but the general dynamic was you had kind of the women's rights, victim advocates, trial lawyers, and some labor unions kind of on the side of lobbying for these new bills. And then you had the big business, employer groups, the Chamber of Commerce, and groups that are really concerned about litigation abuse that were lobbying against them. The most controversial of these bills, they would in some way make it easier for workers to sue over sexual harassment. So that was kind of the big concern for employers. And then that makes it kind of very like a political hot potato.
And as we said, there were more than 24 bills, mm-hmm. really numerous. Whose side did Governor Brown fall on when he reviewed these numerous bills?
Yeah, like you said in the opening, he really mixed it up. He's famous for saying that his approach to politics is, you know, paddle a little on the left and a little on the right, and that's how you get your canoe to go straight down the center. And that's exactly what he did on these Me Too bills. In some cases, he sided with the victims' advocates. In other cases, he sided with the employers. And he signed, you know, one bill that will kind of expand the possibility for lawsuits, and he vetoed another that would have expanded it. So it was a mixed bag.
So let's break down those that did become law mm-hmm. and those that did not. What are some of the new laws that he signed?
So a big one is that, you know, starting next year, there's going to be no more secrecy clauses allowed in settlements for sexual misconduct unless of the victim wants it. He signed a bill that's going to basically require more workplaces to have sexual harassment prevention training. So now instead of workplaces that have 50 or more employees, it's going to be those that have 5 or more. So almost all, you know, companies. He signed an interesting law that's going to require California-based companies to add more women to their boards of directors. And he had an interesting signing message with that one, basically saying that he was kind of unsure about the policy, but believed in the goal and the symbolism of it. And so he was signing it anyway. It was pretty unusual. And then another one he signed that that will make it easier for people to sue for sexual harassment changes the legal standard. You know, previously, in order to bring a sexual harassment case, you had to prove that it was a severe or pervasive problem. That was kind of the phrase in prior court rulings. And the law that he signed basically says one incident is enough. You know, if there's one incident of harassment, that's enough to legally meet the criteria.
Well, had there previously been questions about that?
Yes. And there was almost 20 years ago, there was a ruling in a case with a woman who was a 911 dispatcher in San Mateo who had been groped by a colleague who actually reached his hand inside her shirt, grabbed her breast while she was taking a 911 call, and the colleague ended up spending time in jail on a criminal conviction. But when this woman brought a civil lawsuit, the judge said because it wasn't severe or pervasive, because it was one incident, it was not sexual harassment under the civil code.
As if to say that a one-off is permissible.
Exactly. And so for many years, advocates in this space have said, oh, the law allows one free grope. That was kind of the phrase that they coined.
Wow.
One free grope. Yeah. So Jerry Brown, with his signature, changed that law so that in layman's terms, the law now says, you know, no free gropes.
No free gropes.
Yeah.
So what are some of the bills that he vetoed then?
Well, you know, one that I was really surprised by, there was a bill that basically just required the state government to track harassment complaints and settlements in an annual public report, just kind of some basic government transparency. He vetoed that one. There was a very contentious bill that had to do with arbitration clauses. Mm-hmm. This is kind of what a way that companies sort of push their conflicts with employees into the private arbitration setting rather than into the public court system. And he vetoed that one that would have basically tried to get rid of arbitration, mandatory arbitration. He vetoed one that would require businesses to keep harassment records on file for at least 5 years. And he also vetoed one that simply extended the amount of time from 1 year to 3 years for harassment victims to file complaints. Both of those last two would have sort of in some ways made it easier to bring a lawsuit. If you have, you know, more time to file your complaint, that means more people can complain. That means it can lead to more lawsuits. So he did veto those as well.
I would imagine that last one you mentioned, that the employers were lobbying against that one.
Yeah. You know, like I said, a lot of these, you know, some of these bills kind of targeted government employment, but a lot of them targeted employment much more broadly. And the private sector definitely did push back. The arbitration, the bill to ban mandatory arbitration was the only bill at the end of session that the California Chamber of Commerce called a job killer, which is kind of like their most, those are the bills that they want to kill the most. And so they got a veto, which is what they wanted.
Was there any discernible pattern to what he signed and what he vetoed?
You know, there are some advocates, and one assemblywoman from San Diego, Democratic assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher, who really felt like the bills he signed will mostly help women who work in professional settings, that these are more going to help the kind of white-collar employment sector, and that those he vetoed were the ones that would have done more for working class workers. And so, you know, low wage workers like janitors or maids or waitresses and sales clerks. The arbitration issue is kind of a clause that apparently is very common in these employment contracts for those sort of hourly worker jobs. And so that one definitely would have impacted that sector, as well as the one allowing for more time. You know, the advocates I spoke with said that a lot of these low wage workers are, you know, they're just not as familiar with the law. They don't have as much easy access to attorneys and may not know when something happens to them that it's against the law in the first place. So the bill that would have extended the amount of time to complain from 1 year, which is the law now, to 3 years, which was the proposal he vetoed, would have mostly had the impact of helping those low-wage workers.
I'm talking with CalMatters reporter Laurel Rosenhall about new laws that Governor Brown signed last week that relate to the Me Too movement and the We Said Enough campaign. Laurel, where do you see things headed next, especially now that Governor Brown is leaving office?
Right. So next year we'll have a new governor, and I don't think this fight is over. I mean, there were enough bills kind of left on the cutting room floor here that I anticipate a lot of these will be back next year, and that the legislators and the advocates who are pushing for them are going to try to make their case to a different governor, particularly on the bill regarding mandatory arbitration. That one was backed by the labor unions. It was very important to them. They brought out a full kind of cast of celebrities to lobby for this bill throughout the year, including Jane Fonda came to Sacramento, Gretchen Carlson, the Fox News personality who had sued her employer. And another interesting celebrity lobbying for that bill was Jennifer Siebel Newsom. And of course, she is the feminist filmmaker who is married to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. And so if he is in the governor's office next year, that's kind of an interesting advocate. The supporters of this bill will definitely have a very powerful ally on their side.
Absolutely. Let's touch briefly on what's happening in Washington today. All eyes are on the U.S. Senate as the nation awaits the vote on whether Judge Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit is going to be elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court, the nation's highest court. California Senator Dianne Feinstein has played a very prominent role throughout this and for numerous reasons. Can you talk about how the drama in Washington has colored the California Senate race?
Yeah, it's really added a really interesting layer to the race that was already an interesting race because Dianne Feinstein is getting challenged from the left by State Senator Kevin DeLeon, who's also a Democrat. And of course, we have this top two system in California, which means that on the ballot, we'll have two Democrats this fall. Republicans are absolutely incensed with how Dianne Feinstein has handled this situation, saying that she had known for so long about this allegation because, of course, Christine Blasey Ford told Feinstein about it back in early in the summer in July. And Feinstein held on to it, and didn't say anything throughout her private meetings with Judge Kavanaugh, throughout the public hearings with Judge Kavanaugh. And Republicans feel like she kind of held on to it till the last minute and then launched this effort to try to derail his confirmation, which they understandably feel is kind of rightfully, it's their pick. They have the majority. The president is a Republican. They get to kind of choose how it goes.
And Senator Feinstein has said that the reason that she held on to that information was at the request of Dr. Ford.
Exactly. And Dr. Ford has publicly said that she is pleased with how Senator Feinstein handled the situation. You have what's going on is you have the Republicans attacking Feinstein for this, but Feinstein is not meeting a Republican challenger. And so you also have her being attacked by Kevin DeLeon, her Democratic challenger, who's interestingly, even though he's even more liberal than she is, he's kind of making the same arguments that the Republicans are in this case. Why did she hold on that letter in secret for so long?
It's like partisanship is so entrenched, but can be fleeting during a campaign,
right, exactly,
as well. And as you said, Kevin DeLeon did blast Feinstein pretty aggressively,
yeah,
over how she handled the accuser's information. Here in California, what has the sort of reaction been to that criticism?
This is a case where I think this is an attack that backfired among Democrats and oddly maybe helping him get Republican votes, which is very strange because in terms of his policy priorities, there's really nothing about his policies that your typical Republican would embrace. He's the author of the Sanctuary State Bill, which basically adds new protections for undocumented immigrants. He's super strong on gun control. He's a big kind of climate activist and, pushed for cap and trade and other climate change programs, clean electricity. So your typical Republican in California would really not align with his interests and his priorities. But it's the old my enemy's enemy is my friend. And there are now some Republicans saying that they're going to vote for him just because he's not Feinstein. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's been a lot of blowback against him from some, you know, women, Democratic women who are basically saying, how dare you try to say that how you would handle this woman's complaint? She likes how Senator Feinstein handled it. She's the victim. She gets to decide how to tell her story. If she wanted to keep it in confidence, then that's her decision. And there are a lot of women in California who feel like Democratic women who feel like Feinstein handled this situation with enormous aplomb. And so De Leon attacking her is kind of just adding more fire to their favorable feelings about Senator Feinstein.
And in the meantime, all eyes on Washington as the vote on Brett Kavanaugh is scheduled for tomorrow. That's Laurel Rosenhall from CalMatters for this week's Capital Chat. Laurel, thank you for being on Insight.
Thanks, Pam.
We have full political coverage on our website, capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.
We got support from Brookfield School, preschool through eighth grade, dedicated to challenging each student to reach full potential through a dynamic curriculum and a tradition of cultivating character and excellence. Learn more at brookfieldschool.org. And we got support from Taste Restaurant in Plymouth, announcing a winemaker dinner featuring Fate Wines Sunday, October 21st, pairing seasonal menu favorites with wines of Amador County. Reservations at restauranttaste.com.
Coming up next on Insight with Pamela Wu, we're going to hear about an art exhibit called Journey of Hope, telling stories and raising awareness about mental illness to fight the stigma that surrounds it. And that's coming up next on Insight with Pamela Wu, filling in for Beth Ruyak. This is the kind of programming that you count on from Cap Radio. Please call and support it with a contribution at 1-800-800-5867. I'm Steve Milne with Sammy Kayola.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
It is our fun drive. It's an exciting time here at the station, and it's an extra exciting time because we have a special match program right now, which means if you make a donation to Cap Radio, it's going to work twice as hard toward our mission of sustaining our community with facts and entertainment. Every donation that you make is going to be matched up to $100,000. That is going to go a really long way for what we do here at Cap Radio. So if you've been looking for the right time to donate, this is a good time. It's going to go double. That's a big deal. You can do that by calling us at 1-800-800-5867. Here's that number again, 1-800-800-5867. You can do it online safely and securely at capradio.org.
How about this when you contribute to Cap Radio and support programs like Insight? Get a pair of Cap Radio-themed wireless headphones. They're perfect for listening to Insight and keeping up with NPR and Cap Radio news, plus music shows like Hey Listen on Saturday nights. Ask for the wireless headphones when you make a monthly gift of $30 or more. Go to capradio.org or call us at 1-800-800-5867.
You know what else wireless headphones are good for, Steve?
No.
Dance parties.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't get tangled up in that cord.
Yeah, good point.
And we have another special thank you gift. Anybody who donates right now gets a collection of Cap Radio stickers. They are really cute, and they really nod to some of our favorite programs here at Cap Radio, and they can go on your computer or your bike helmet or your coffee mug, really anything. So that'll show your support. You know, if you really identify with a member of Capital Public Radio, if that's important to you, call now and donate. Get those stickers. That's at 1-800-800-5867.
Insight and Cap Radio News keeps you connected with fascinating people in your community doing really amazing things, and it's worth your support. You listen to Insight, you listen to Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Science Friday coming up a little bit later. These are programs that you depend on to keep you informed and entertained. Cap Radio is counting on you to help pay for it with a contribution. So please do it now, 1-800-800-5867.
And one of the best ways to donate is to go evergreen. That means that you give us your bank account information and you're always on our files as a monthly sustainer. So you don't have to worry about whether your membership is current, because you are current. You are one of our sustaining members and you help keep us going. So it's time to go evergreen, and you'll be entered into our grand prize drawings. This time that includes a trip to the Galapagos Islands and the Amazon rainforest valued at $9,000. The best way to be entered is to go evergreen. You can do that by calling 1-800-800-5867. It's 1-800-800-5867, or hop online at capradio.org.
Yeah, donate for everything you hear. Insight, Marketplace, Morning Edition, they all count. Make your donation now by phone at 1-800-800-5867 or online at capradio.org.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. Mental illness is more common than you might think. In Sacramento County alone, for example, more than 300,000 people live with mental illness. Next week is Mental Illness Awareness Week, and a project titled Mental Illness, It's Not Always What You Think, seeks to raise awareness about mental illness and fight the stigma that surrounds it. And it's employing a collaborative art exhibit called Journey of Hope to tell stories and inspire understanding. Joining us today are Chantal Allen-Jarrell, health educator for Sacramento County, and Karen Hinson, the coordinator for the Journey of Hope exhibit. Chantal and Karen, welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
Thank you.
The exhibit's full name is Journey of Hope, Real Life Stories of Living with Mental Health Challenges Portrayed Through Art. And it's going to be on display at the Elk Grove Fine Arts Center beginning this weekend. Chantal, why are art and stories an ideal medium for exploring the topic of mental illness?
Well, for the fourth year, Sacramento County Division of Behavioral Health Services is partnering with Elk Grove Fine Arts Center to bring the event to the public. But the collaborative art exhibit pairs local artists with writers who are sharing personal stories of struggle, hope, and recovery with mental challenges. And participating artists are matched with writers to create an artistic portrayal of these stories. But the show is an amazing display of insight, inspiration, and understanding, strength, and connection to display mental illness and the truth behind it.
Karen, how did you come to be involved with Journey of Hope?
I have been a volunteer with the Mental Illness It's Not Always What You Think project as a public speaker for a few years now. And we got an email blast asking if anybody wanted to help with this Journey of Hope project. And I looked it up and I looked at the website and I saw that it was portraying mental illnesses in a different light than they usually were. Because a lot of people only hear about mental illnesses in a very negative context, and I wanted to be a part of this because it was casting mental illness in a positive light and showing all of the good that can happen even with mental illness. And it was going to do a lot, I felt like, to reduce the stigma surrounding mental illness for both the participants and the people who came to view the show.
Can we define the term mental illness for our listeners? It's sort of an umbrella term that covers a lot, and it's more inclusive than people might think. And I'd like to pose this question to both of you. So, Chantal, let's start with you.
Yes. So the way I like to help define mental illness is first by stepping back and defining mental health. And so, you know, we have heart health, we have respiratory health, we have mental health. And mental illness, I would say, is just the spectrum in which illness lies for mental health.
Karen, your thoughts?
I like to talk, when people talk about mental illness, they tend to think of these big five diseases like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, but there's more than that. Those are mental illnesses, and people with those can still live amazing lives. We have a lot of participants in our show who have illnesses like that, who are amazing people, who've done great artwork. But anxiety is a mental illness, and depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a lot of things that can kind of interfere with your everyday functioning for your mental health that would be a mental illness. It doesn't have to be what you see in the TV and the movies. There's a lot of things that could be a mental illness or that could affect your mental health, and they're all very important and they're all very valid.
And that sounds like it's a misconception. Karen, what are some of the other misconceptions in the community about mental illness that you wish people knew?
I wish people knew more about the misconception that people with a mental illness can't be good friends, or that they can't be in relationships, that they aren't worthy of promotions or of doing great things in their lives. You wouldn't deny someone a promotion for having diabetes, and a mental illness shouldn't get in the way of that either. People with mental illnesses are people.
Chantal, what do you wish people knew?
One of the things that our project, you know, strives to educate is that mental illness isn't a result of moral failing, personal weakness, or a lack of willpower. Many people also believe mental illness is not treatable, but it certainly is. Such beliefs may explain why only 1/3 of individuals seek treatment, and 2/3 of those who are living with mental illness do not seek treatment, and stigma is a huge barrier to that.
Sacramento County's project titled Mental Illness, It's Not Always What You Think, was launched in 2012. What is that about?
Yes. Yeah, so the project Mental Illness, It's Not Always What You Think was launched in an effort to reduce stigma and discrimination. It is funded by Proposition 63, the Mental Health Services Act. And so the main pitch line is we're looking at, as you said in the introduction, roughly 1 in 5 adults will experience a diagnosable mental health issue during their lifetime, and nearly 1 out of every 5 children will experience emotional or behavioral difficulty. So here in Sacramento County, for our population, that would equate to approximately 300,000 individuals in our community who live with mental illness. But again, only 1/3 of those will seek treatment and services, where 2/3 go untreated.
If you do the math, that's more than 200,000 people going untreated.
Yes. So, I mean, the project aim, we want to reduce stigma and discrimination around mental illness, promote mental health and wellness, and inspire hope for people and families living with mental illness.
So the project Mental Illness, It's Not Always What You Think, it's been going on for 6 years mm-hmm. now. How do you measure success?
Looking at awareness, you know, going out into the community, and I would say, as colloquial as it sounds, is that awareness of our project, awareness of understanding that stigma and discrimination is a huge problem with mental illness. So I would say in my short time is it's great to go out into the community and people are aware of the project and they understand that that they can try to reduce stigma and discrimination in small ways within themselves and their families and their communities. So I would say unofficially, that's a great way how we like to measure the success of the project.
I'm talking with Chantal Allen-Jurel, health educator for Sacramento County, and Karen Hinson, the coordinator for the Journey of Hope exhibit, about what's happening in Sacramento County to recognize Mental Illness Awareness Week. Karen, you mentioned stigma. How do you think stigma prevents people from seeking help?
I think a lot of people who don't seek the help, that 200,000 we were talking about a second ago, a lot of them, they don't seek help or they kind of ignore their mental illness because they don't want the people in their lives to look at them differently or treat them differently. If your friends or your coworkers or your family find out that you have a mental illness, a lot of people do look at you differently or treat you differently. They treat you like you're breakable, like you're broken, like you have a mental illness because you're lazy or because you're immoral or you need to go to church more or for whatever reason. People are very afraid of the effect that coming out about this mental illness is going to have on them and the relationships in their lives.
You know, advocates such as yourselves, I've heard advocates say that it is stigmatizing and negative to use language such as you're crazy or that's insane. How important are the words that we use in regards to mental illness?
Very important. With those examples, when we go out and with the Speakers Bureau and do presentations, we try to educate about using words such as crazy, because it's always the looking at what do you mean by using the word crazy? And an example I always like to say is, I had a crazy day today. Well, what does that mean to you? Did you have a busy day? Was it a little chaotic? Was it stressful? Using simple word substitutions to really define what you mean by what you're trying to portray.
What are your thoughts on that, Karen, the use of language?
I think that using words like crazy or insane to describe something, if you're speaking around someone who has a mental illness, they're making a little mental note. It's like, oh, do they think that I'm whatever they're trying to describe, whatever negative word they're trying to use? Because it's usually used as a negative word. It's if I talk to them about a mental health symptom that I have, are they going to turn around and say like, oh, she's crazy, Karen is stressful or too busy to be around or too chaotic? It's even if your friend maybe understands that they're not talking about you, there's still that slight connection that they might see you that way, that the people in your life might see you that way.
What behaviors or signs should we look for in a friend or in loved ones who might have mental illness? Karen?
A big one, especially for me and a lot of people I know, is withdrawing from something. If someone who comes to game night every week stops coming for a few weeks in a row, I mean, they could be busy, but they might be having a depressive episode or they might be stressed or anxious. And it's always good to check in. Someone who's quieter than they used to be. Someone who's just behavior changes in general. Mm-hmm. I guess if your friends aren't acting the way they normally do, something might be up. It's good to check in.
Chantal, I see you nodding. What signs do you look for?
I would say, like Karen mentioned, is extreme mood swings. I mean, so it could be the full spectrum of depressive states, but also looking at someone who may be manic or extreme anger. But also, like as Karen mentioned again, excessive worry or anxiety would be also just general signs and symptoms to keep an eye out for.
Chantal, what resources are available to someone who might be living with mental illness or someone whose loved one might be living with mental illness?
With our project, we like to refer people to 211, and they could place a call and to learn more about mental health resources in the community. It's free, it's anonymous, and to choose from over 2,000 resources that could serve as something in the community that they can turn to. But also, we like to share our website, www.stopstigmasacramento.org, as also a way to learn more about the project.
Karen, finally, let's wrap up by putting in a final word about the Journey of Hope exhibit, for which you're the coordinator. What can folks who visit this exhibit expect?
They can expect some amazing artwork. We have some very talented artists this year over at the Elk Grove Fine Arts Center. We have a bunch of really good stories, too, in a variety of mediums. We have some narrative stories. We have some poems, all kinds of things. Some really talented writers and some really talented artists coming together to work to end the stigma surrounding mental illness.
What do you want people who visit the exhibit to walk away with?
I want them to walk away with an understanding of the complexity and beauty of all of the participants' lives, both in and around mental illness, that the mental illness isn't them, it's just a part of the many, many things that make them them.
And Chantal, what do you want visitors to the exhibit to take away?
That those living with mental illness are everyday people in our community. And I believe we have 42 pairs of participants, so a total of 84 individuals who came together to exhibit their real-life stories of mental illness and the art that has portrayed them.
That's Chantal Allen-Jarrell, health educator for Sacramento County, and Karen Hinson, the coordinator of the Journey of Hope exhibit, talking about erasing the stigma surrounding mental illness and what can be done to help people who live with it. Chantal and Karen, thank you for being on Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The public reception for the exhibit, Journey of Hope, Real-Life Stories of Living with Mental Health Challenges, Portrayed Through Art, will be held tomorrow, October 6th, from 3 to 7 p.m. The exhibit will be on display at the Elk Grove Fine Arts Center, free and open to the public through October 20th. And you'll find information about the event on our website, capradio.org/insight. I'm Pamela Wu. This is Insight with Beth Ruyak on listener-supported Capital Public Radio.
If you're tuning in to Insight on Cap Radio, you just heard a pretty powerful segment about the stigma that people living with mental illness face and their journeys to recovery. I'm Sammy Kayola. I'm our healthcare reporter, and mental health is a really big part of what I do. I just put out a 6-month project on how to prevent rural suicide in faraway areas of California, and I talked to dozens of people who struggle with mental illness, and you know, it was really an eye-opening project for me and hopefully for our listeners as well.
Oh yeah, it was an amazing project. And I know a lot of work went into it and a lot of teamwork went into it. And listeners are part of that, too, because we are a listener-supported organization. And so we can't do the work we do, great journalism, without listener support. Please call and support it. Support what you hear from Sammy Kayola, our healthcare reporter at Cap Radio, and the work that you hear on Insight with a contribution at 1-800-800-5867. This morning only, start your donation to Cap Radio or make an additional gift, and it'll be doubled. Call or donate online now and have your contribution work twice as hard for Cap Radio and really for you, because you're getting the benefits when you listen. 1-800-800-5867.
And maybe you want to donate, but you think you're a little too busy, but you can find a couple of minutes. It's really quick. And we heard this morning, actually, from Allegra in Rocklin. They said, "I'm at my 40th high school reunion in Florida, but I still logged on to do this."
Wow.
Yeah. So donating to Cap Radio must be pretty important to Allegra, who made the time to donate because Cap Radio is a meaningful meaningful aspect of their lives. So you can call in and do that. It's very quick at 1-800-800-5867 or online at capradio.org. Don't let the day get away from you. Pick up the phone.
Yeah, we have a goal this hour of 61 contributions, and we're nearly there. We only have about 5 to go, so you can help us get there and get the good feeling of knowing you did your part to support Insight with Beth Ruyak and all the great programs that you rely on. CapRadio.org, safely and securely at our website, or give us a call at 1-800-800-5867.
Yeah, and if you go online to donate, you'll see lots of news updates and Insight, extended segments, photos. You know, that's the great thing about Cap Radio is you can access it anywhere, on your computer, on your phone, on your smart speaker. It's important to us to be accessible to you because we know that you rely on our programming to get you through your morning commute or dropping your kids off or just relaxing in the evenings maybe. So if the Cap Radio is something that's really part of your routine that restores balance in your life or keeps you informed or helps you learn something new, those are all great reasons to donate to Cap Radio. You can do that by calling 1-800-800-5867. Again, 1-800-800-5867, or do it online. It just takes a couple of minutes at capradio.org.
Northern California has its fair share of cities and towns with unusual names, from Bootjack to Rough and Ready. Cap Radio Interactive producer Emily Zentner decided to give in to her curiosity and take a look at the history behind some of these names. That's coming up next on Insight. Your contribution helps pay for this great journalism. Please do it now, 1-800-800-5867. Our website is full of, you know, not only stories that you hear, but also additional information, photos, videos that we can't obviously, you know, do on the radio. So go to capradio.org, not only to stream what you hear, but also to check out more in-depth coverage of the stories that you hear on Cap Radio. 1-800-800-5867 is the number to support it. And go to capradio.org to check out that stuff or to support Cap Radio with a donation.
Steve, you were talking about Emily's piece, Places That Are Near to Us. What about places that are far? Call now and enter in our drawing for the Galapagos Islands, 1-800-800-5867.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu. Beth Ruyak is going to return on Monday. Northern California has its fair share of cities and towns with unusual names, from Bootjack to Rough and Ready. Cap Radio Interactive producer Emily Zentner decided to give into her curiosity and take a look at the history behind some of these names. And she is joining us on Insight here today. Emily, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What inspired this story?
So I came across a story done by KQED this summer that went through some of the origins of place names of Bay Area places. And I thought that we have so many interesting place names around Sacramento that it would be worth looking into. And I'm actually from Sacramento, so I kind of had a stockpile in my head of things I wanted to know about personally, and we just built off of that.
Well, let's start with Sacramento itself. Where does our city's name come from?
So Sacramento means sacrament in Spanish, which is not a surprise.
Right.
But it's just a reference to the Catholic Eucharist or communion. And it was originally the name of the river. And then American settlers took the name of the river and gave it to the city. So that's where it came from.
Oh, so the river was named first.
It was.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. So many cities in California have Spanish names, Santa Maria, San Francisco. But not this next one, Rough and Ready. What's that one about?
So Rough and Ready's name is actually less weird than it sounds, which is surprising. So Rough and Ready is actually kind of an honor to President Zachary Taylor, who was known as Old Rough and Ready when he was a general in the Mexican-American War. And after the war, a lot of soldiers moved to California looking for wealth. And so we actually have a Rough and Ready Island, too, near Stockton. And it's just kind of a little ode to him, the general in the Mexican-American War.
And I grew up in Stockton, so I absolutely remember this. It's right off of I-5. Here's another memorable name, Bootjack. What's a bootjack, and how did the town come to be named Bootjack?
So first off, a bootjack is a tool that you can use to take your boots off. So it's not something that we use a lot in the modern era.
Or ever.
But it's basically something you can hook your boot heel in, and it will pull your boot off. And bootjack, the name for bootjack and the story behind it is a little bit more legend than fact, I'm afraid. But I did get the story from someone who knows Mariposa County history really well. And there are two stories about Bootjack's name. And the first one is a little bit more on the mundane side. And that's that there was a fork in the road that just looked like a bootjack. But Mariposa History Museum docent and motherlode of Mariposa History host Chris Allen actually told me about a second story that I thought was a little bit more fun. And I'll let Chris tell you that.
The second is probably more legend. And it has to do with a horse thief that was hung back in the day during the gold rush. And somebody else came along after this poor guy was hung and wanted his boots for himself, tried to take them from the body, and they were on so tight that he had to use a boot jack to remove the boots from the horse thief.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I know.
This isn't TV, so you can't see, but my mouth fell open when they said that. It's a little gruesome, but yes, you're right. It's a very interesting and memorable story. We're talking with Cap Radio's digital producer, Emily Zentner, about cities and towns in California with unusual names. Let's talk about a truly iconic Northern California landmark. How did Lake Tahoe get its name?
So this is actually one of my favorite stories. So Lake Tahoe, the Washoe tribe believes that they have lived in the Lake Tahoe area since the beginning of time, basically. And their name for the lake was Da'au'aga, which means edge of the lake in the Washoe language. So then when non-native settlers moved into the area, they heard Da'au, and eventually it kind of got mispronounced into Lake Tahoe. Mm-hmm. And I actually talked with Herman Fillmore, who works with the tribe, and he told me a little bit about what he thinks about the anglicized name for Lake Tahoe.
The thing that's kind of funny to us is that, you know, calling it Lake Tahoe or Lake Da'au is just like calling it Lake Lake, which is kind of hilarious when we talk about those things in our communities. It's even the same thing outside of Reno. You may have heard of Mount Talak or Mount Talak. Our word for mountain is Dalak, and so we kind of talk about it as this story where some ignorant settler came in and they're asking for names and trying to be respectful, I believe. But they asked for the name of this mountain, and we pointed at the mountain and said, oh, that's Dalak, that's a mountain. And so they said, oh, Mount Dalak, mountain, that's cool. And so we often kind of find the humor in it, that people didn't necessarily understand the greater meaning of what we were saying kind of thing. And so you see this lack of cultural understanding between two peoples that are linguistically diverse.
That is a great quote from him.
Yeah, I thought it was super interesting and super indicative of California and how things were formed here.
Yes, and redundantly redundant.
Yes.
Yes. What do these names tell us about Northern California history?
Yeah, so there were two things that I noticed when I was looking through these names. And the first one was that the origin of the names come from three groups that are really influential to California. And you really don't see any names that don't fit into these three groups. You see it very rarely. So we have names that came from gold rush miners settling towns, names that came from Native American tribes, and names that came from Hispanic settlers. So we've kind of got three groups. And then I also noticed that the names I found all came from the same 30-year period between 1840 and 1870. And so I talked to Sac State Professor Brendan Lindsay about that and kind of asked him why that time period was so important for naming places in California.
Part of the kind of bonanza of naming that goes on really is just very practical. California in 1848 becomes part of the United States, and then, in 1849, we created a constitution, and in 1850, got admitted as a state. So military and government surveyors were sent out in order to map the boundaries of California officially, particularly after statehood.
And after statehood, we also had some more milestones during that time. We had the arrival of the railroad in California and the gold rush, and settlements just kept popping up, and they had to be named as they popped up. So that's why we have all those names from that period.
That was the time that people said, we got to name all these places.
Absolutely.
You can't just say that group of people living over there.
Yeah, that place.
I feel like I should ask you a personal question, because I've enjoyed this conversation so much, and I can tell that you had a really good time doing this story.
Yeah, I did. I'm a total history nerd, and I'm from California, so this was totally up my alley, learning about the history of different places, and it was just something that I was really personally curious about, so it was a lot of fun to learn all of that.
Do you think you might do it again?
I might. It was a lot of work. We'll see. We'll have to see.
All right. Well, if you do, we definitely look forward to hearing it. That's CAP Radio's Emily Zentner talking about her feature on the name origins of California cities, towns, and landmarks. Emily, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
To read more of these origin stories and see a map of the names that Emily learned about, head to capradio.org. This is Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu, filling in for Beth Ruyak. Beth is going to be back on Monday. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.
You know, hearing Pamela Wu interview Emily Zentner, it's just an illustration of, you know, CAP Radio is not just radio anymore. It's our digital content, our podcasts like Yosemite Land and Keys to the House, social media. We're all over the place. Your contribution helps make CAP Radio happen, whether it's online, our podcasts, or on the radio. So please call now with a contribution at 1-800-800-5867.
From Sacramento State, this is Capital Public Radio, 90.9 KXJZ FM and HD Sacramento, 91.3 KUOP FM and HD Stockton Modesto, 90.5 KKTO Tahoe City Reno, and 88.1 KQNC Quincy. We got support from the Calaveras Visitors Bureau, home of the Mark Twain Wild West Fest in Angels Camp, Saturday the 20th, a full day of entertainment celebrating life on the wild frontier. GoCalaveras.com/Mark Twain Wild West Fest. And join us in support of the Roseville Jazz Festival and its summer concert series featuring jazz harpist Motoshi Kosako with the Motoshi Kosako Trio on Friday, October 12th. More information at capradio.org/events.
It's our fall fun drive here at CAP Radio. I'm Sammy Kayola, healthcare reporter. I'm in the studio with Steve Milne. And Steve, I don't know if you've ever seen me ride my bike near the studio, but I've got this bike helmet that's sort of an art project. It's covered in stickers that I've been curating for years from breweries that I like or my favorite little stores. And just recently, I put a new sticker on it. It's a Yosemite Land sticker.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, from Ezra's amazing podcast. And listeners, you can have a sticker like that too. In fact, you can have a whole collection of CAP Radio stickers if you donate during this fun drive. There are stickers for Hey Listen, for PolitiFact, for Insight. I mean, I'm going to get all of them. I'm going to deck my bike helmet out even more. So if you have something you would like to decorate, call now and donate for these limited time stickers at 1-800-800-5867. That's 1-800-800-5867.
You know, covering the California Capitol isn't a 9-to-5 job. Budget deals and key votes on legislation have happened in the early hours of the morning to late in the evening. CAP Radio's Capital Bureau is committed to the news no matter when it's happening. We're asking you to commit a contribution to help fund it. We've got our capital coverage. We've got health coverage from Sammy Kayola. We've got environment from Ezra David Romero. All these great reporters. Julia Mietrich covers food and sustainability. I mean, everybody's got their beat, but we also do like general assignment things. Sometimes you've got to
You never know when you're going to be sent out to a festival or a press conference.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of CAP Radio. Our reporters are really talented. But it's again, it's not a 9-to-5 job. Sometimes we're working, and this isn't a complaint. It's just we're there for you. We work hard for you. And you hear that when you listen to CAP Radio and when you listen to shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So please call with a contribution. You count on CAP Radio. CAP Radio is depending on you. 1-800-800-5867.
And remember, we don't just cover downtown Sacramento. We cover the greater Sacramento region and even into Nevada. We've heard this morning from people all over California who appreciate what they hear. We heard from Janie in Turlock, from Martin in Sacramento, Leslie in San Ramon, Michael in Modesto, and from Maddie, also in Sacramento. So thank you to everyone who's called in. And if you didn't hear your neighborhood, maybe you live in Fair Oaks or in West Sacramento or somewhere up north like Marysville, maybe call and represent where you live and you'll get a little shout out maybe too. So if you want to represent your area, call and donate at 1-800-800-5867. Help us fill in our map.
We heard about Rough and Ready in places like Bootjack from Emily Zentner and her great project. Well, how about this? Galapagos Islands and the Amazon rainforest. Well, we're offering a trip. It's one of our grand prize drawings during this fun drive. And we're offering you the trip this January. Your donation could send you there on the house. So contribute now. You might just win. Contribute by phone, 1-800-800-5867 or capradio.org.
And don't procrastinate. I can tell you I'm often a procrastinator, but if you put this on a to-do list, you might lose track of it. You don't know how the rest of your day is going to go, and you don't want this to get lost in the scramble. If Cap Radio is important to you, take just a few minutes out of your day to give us a call now at 1-800-800-5867. And if you have your bank routing number ready, you can just choose the amount that you want to contribute and become an evergreen donor. And every little amount counts. We call them little micro donations. Once a month, and you won't even have to worry about it. And you'll know that you are helping Cap Radio continue in bringing you the important journalism that we bring you every day.
Here and now, coming up in moments, we've got Science Friday, Fresh Air, The World, all your favorite programs that you count on from Cap Radio. This radio station is depending on you to help pay for it with a contribution. It only takes a couple of moments. You can do it safely and securely at our website, capradio.org, or give us a call at 1-800-800-5867. We had special live coverage this morning of the U.S. Senate vote on the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. So we weren't able to, you know, ask for your support, and that's okay. We want to make sure that you have the coverage that you depend on. But now's the time to show your support for that kind of coverage that you depend on from Cap Radio. 1-800-800-5867.
And remember I said do it today? Well, that's because right now there's a matching donation, which means any donation that you give is going to be doubled. That's a big deal for us. That's going to go a really long way. So don't put it off. Give now. It's a special opportunity. It's a special matching donation. Call and have your donation mean even more than it usually does today at 1-800-800-5867. You can also donate online. It's quick and easy at capradio.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.